This is the official Euro 2024 podcast.
The Netherlands trailed to Turkey, but turned the tie around to reach the Euro 2024 semi-finals.
Their win sets up a last four showdown with England after they squeezed past Switzerland on penalties.
It's Trent Alexander-Arnold. And England are into the semi-finals! Alexander-Arnold with an arrow into the net. And having been on the cusp of going out, England have rescued themselves again, and they will play in the final four.
The dream of a first Euro success still very much alive for Gareth Southgate's team.
We look back at Saturday's action and preview the semi-finals, including Spain versus France. Hello and welcome to the Euro Show. The final whistle has just gone in Berlin, where the Dutch are celebrating in the stands in all orange. The players dancing in front of their section of support after they came from 1-0 down to beat Turkey 2-1, Chris.
High drama in the stadium, which will host the final of Euro in a little over a week. One end of the stadium, or actually most of the stadium, decked out in disappointed Turkey colours, really, after a very, very good performance. But the Dutch, with their smallish band of orange, quite literally jigging from side to side. They've just reenacted their song, which has hit the streets of Germany since they came here, when they go from right to left, left to right, and then all jig around. And the players and the fans are still doing it, as you can hear in the background. And they are through to a first Euro semi-final for 20 years. And this party is going to go long, long into the nights. We're also joined by the European football expert, Andy Brassel. Great scenes of Dutch celebration, which we are witnessing.
Yeah, amazing. And I think there's always a little hint of sadness when the host nation gets knocked out of a tournament. And especially a host nation like Germany have been, they've been really vibrant. I really think the UEFA Euro 2024 needed an occasion like this tonight, off as well as on the pitch, between arguably the two most colourful sets of fans at this European Championship, and it really has delivered in Berlin tonight.
Certainly has. The Dutch players are all blowing kisses to their family members as they finally leave the pitch. Nobody in orange, though, is doing that in the stands. They're taking this all in. Denzel Dumfries doing another little dance as he heads down the tunnel. Of course, they will hope to walk out of the very same tunnel in, 8 days' time for the Euro final in Berlin. A lot to go through before then, but tonight is for the Dutch, and the Turkey players still doing their lap of honour, many in tears. As Andy mentioned, Rob, they have given this tournament so much, including tonight. And for so long, you thought it was going to be them going through to the semi-finals.
One of those crying we can see as they walk around the perimeter of the pitch is the captain returning from suspension, Hakan Çalhanoğlu, walking alongside Vincenzo Montella. In many ways, some of these games have felt like Turkey home games, haven't they?
Yeah.
Because of their local support. Mm. But their Euro journey ends this evening. And we want your thoughts on what we've seen today. Get in touch via X using @Euro2024. A reminder as well, we're live every match night of the competition, or you can catch up with the show as the official podcast. We'll get reaction as well to England's victory on penalties over Switzerland shortly. But let's stay in Berlin, where the Netherlands took on Turkey.
As far as Güler, Güler can reload for Bruggen, struggling, Turkey lead! Akkaydin got big backstick, and this ebullient nation is in front once more. Memphis Depay, smashing header, Dutch equaliser, Stefan de Vrij, 1-1. Weghorst, Simons, Dumfries, it's Smoltz home! And from behind, the Netherlands lead! Cody Gakpo right on the line!
And he gets the better of Mulder. Is that an on goal? That will be checked. It doesn't matter if you're the
right.
Netherlands, yeah.
Might well be a Mulder own goal, mightn't it?
Yeah, it has gone down as an own goal for now, but the score irrelevant, really. It's important for the Dutch that they are through and they march on in this competition. Andy, the Dutch came into this with the same 11 that beat Romania, one of the performances of the competition so far. Turkey had to make changes with Demiral suspended, for example, but Çalhanoğlu was back. What did you make of the first half, one in which Turkey took the lead through another set piece?
And they were excellent. I thought the Netherlands came out of the traps really quickly. Excellent first 15 minutes from them. And, you know, you wonder how much the last 16 game against Austria had coloured, been coloured by the early goal for Turkey in that. It enabled them to control the game from there, but they came at this the other way round. They were under pressure early on, and they managed to deal with it. And I think their organisation, generally, in these knockout games, they've always been entertaining, but they've had a poise in these two games that I think a lot of people considered beyond them. And that's huge credit to Vincenzo Montella. That they were really, really good in the first half, deserved their lead at half-time. Arda Güler, again, absolutely superb. And it was the Netherlands that wanted to make it chaotic in the second half, bringing on Wout Weghorst, trying to mix it up, create a bit of panic in that Turkey defence. But the way they recovered from going 2-1 down, I thought, was excellent. Real credit to them. So very, very good second half by the Dutch, I thought. But, you know, if we were still talking about this game now, if it was still going on now, I don't think that would have been unjust.
Yeah, I mean, they had major chances at the end, Turkey, to equalise. A heroic block from Mickey van der Ven, who had come on, and some other key moments at the back for the Netherlands.
The
Verbruggen save. And actually, it was a game from a neutral perspective. You thought, do you know what? If there's an equaliser here, I don't mind this. I fancy 30 more minutes of this.
Yes.
Because it was... And was this to be expected? Some of the other quarterfinals have been more kind of chess-like in their tactics. Was this always going to be a bit more kind of, you used the word chaotic, but in a good way, kind of attacking a little bit more off the cuff at times?
Yeah, I think you can argue that. Like I said, I've been really impressed by the Turkey poise that they've had in these knockout games. That they have found a level of control. But having said that, I felt that against Romania, the Dutch really found themselves as well. A performance that said, okay, we're getting serious in this tournament now. Now, I wonder if they will look back, and you know, sometimes you see, for a team that does very well in the tournament, a group stage defeat sort of pulls everything back into order. And Ronald Koeman didn't mince his words, did he, after they lost to Austria in that game 3 in this very same stadium in Berlin. He was very, very upset with his players after that. And they seem to have taken that to heart and really, really responded since.
Wout Weghorst came on at halftime, as you mentioned. So after the opening goal for Turkey, after 35 minutes... Brilliant header from Stefan de Vrij to equalise with 20 minutes to go. And then 6 minutes later came the moment that the Dutch ultimately won it. How much of an impact did Weghorst have, as well as his personal performance, just the kind of the change in structure around him?
Yeah, I think it made a massive difference. I think it was probably their most successful stab at getting Xavi Simons into a game so far. It freed Memphis to do a few different things as well, to drift out into wide positions. Now, of course, Xavi Simons has provided 3 assists in this tournament, so not to diminish the influence he's had. But those of us who've seen him in the Bundesliga this season know that he can run games, know that he can be one of the very best players in this tournament. And we saw a few hints of that, actually. But I think we have to give an enormous amount of credit to Ronald Koeman, because if we look at the change he made at halftime, of course, Steven Bergwijn, the unfortunate player to be taken off at halftime, both against Romania and against Turkey here, but completely different substitution each time, because Daniel Malen, who wants to stretch the game, who has pace, is someone who came on at halftime and made a huge difference against Romania, and this time it was Weghorst. So, you know, we associate the Dutch with playing a certain way. But Ronald Koeman, despite having come from that incredible lineage of Rinus Michels, mm-hmm. of Johan Cruyff, of Barcelona, of PSV in 1988, all that sort of stuff. He's not wedded to one particular philosophy. He's a lot more flexible than perhaps we expect of Dutch football.
You mentioned Koeman there. Of course, Rob, the Netherlands' one major success was in Germany at Euro in 88 when Koeman played alongside Rijkaard and Hullit and Van Basten and co. when they won it in Munich, ultimately the final. Let's see if they can head back to Berlin now. They've got a pretty big semi-final, which we'll get on to get through, first of all, of course.
I think his in-game coaching is really going to come to the fore in this tournament. If I even think back to qualifying, the way he would adjust things in game, the switch between three and four at the back as well, that was mentioned. I think the game against the Republic of Ireland, they were at 1-1, fortunately, at half-time in Dublin. He completely changed the system. Ireland didn't react, and the Dutch dominated the game and went on to win it. I think it's also worth pointing to this defensive rear guard. Chris mentioned, you mentioned some of those blocks. It also speaks not only to the fight, and we saw that from the Netherlands at the end of the game. Remarkable fight. But there's just quality. I mean, the players they can bring off the bench at centre-back, especially, is incredible.
And it's not really what we expect from the Netherlands, is it? You know, we associate them with magicians on the ball, with a dazzling front three, and positional interchanging. But actually, they've come in with, as you say, Rob, an extraordinary amount of defensive depth. I mean, an England fan said to me earlier in the tournament, they've got better defenders on the substitutes bench than we've got on the pitch. You know, they've just got an extraordinary amount of good defenders. On the other hand, if you were talking about Koeman's tactical adaptability, he's been forced to be that in this tournament in particular, because, of course, you look at the players who had to pull out even before the tournament started from the same area, from the midfield. So
Frankie de Jong in the stands, actually, on the night. Yeah.
De Jong is a big one. Also, Martin de Roon, who's brilliant for Atalanta in their UEFA Europa League campaign, their victorious campaign. Tern Koopmeiners, his club teammate as well. So that's a lot of things to deal with. And, of course, it means that maybe the defence is a little bit more exposed than it would normally be. So they've had to adapt to that as well. And they've had to defend their own penalty box more than they might have expected to.
We're just seeing Virgil van Dijk, talking of great Dutch defenders, doing an interview. Big beaming smile. And the other thing about the Dutch going through is that we'll get to witness these scenes again. These are the scenes that we've seen before every match. They were doing it 10 minutes ago in the stadium as well. And this is now going to transport to Dortmund for the semi-finals. Now, the Dutch missed, Andy, a number of major tournaments, including Euro 2016, of course. But they've made up for it, right, in their numbers and their colours and their enjoyment of this trip to Germany.
Yeah, they have. And when you think of the restrictions of the last UEFA Euro because of COVID, we've talked about this being a massive celebration for football supporters all over the continent. And the Dutch certainly have taken this opportunity with both hands. As I was saying to you a while back, I was caught in a Netherlands fan march on the way to the stadium in Leipzig before the game against France in the group stages, and it was extraordinary. Obviously, I look ridiculous not wearing orange, but apart from that, it was a real joy to behold.
They also had a number of former internationals on the bus that goes with that march, including Wesley Sneijder and Ron Vlaar, and they were all wearing replica Netherlands kits, just getting involved as fans. Stefan de Vrij, by the way, picked out yesterday on the show by Derek Brookman as the team's unsung hero. Well, he's the hero tonight. He's won player of the match after his super header and fine defensive display. Okay, next, we'll get stuck into today's other quarterfinal.
Cardiac arrest can happen to anyone. On a football pitch, at work, but most often at home.
CPR can save lives.
Get trained now.
Learn the skills to save lives. Visit get-train.com.
So let's focus next on what happened in Dusseldorf, where England took on Switzerland.
Cher, that's a nice disguised pass. And Doyer Cross could go anywhere, it's in! Brilliant Polo is there for Switzerland! And
they can touch their first ever semi-final now. Saka goes for goal and scores a stunner! England are back level and it's sensational from Saka. Just when it looked like they might be heading out again, England have come up with an equaliser. Akanji saved by Pickford, who gets down to his left to keep out Manuel Akanji, and it's advantage England in the shootout. It's Trent Alexander-Arnold, and England are into the semi-finals. Alexander-Arnold with an arrow into the net, and having been on the cusp of going out, England have rescued themselves again, and they will play in the final four.
Yes, 1-1 after 120 minutes, but Gareth Southgate's 100th game in charge, ending in a 5-3 penalty shootout win for England. We heard Mark Scott on commentary there, and delighted to say he joins us from Dusseldorf. Mark, good evening.
Evening, guys.
It went the whole way, and England are victorious.
They are, and it was a really tight game, wasn't it? I think overall Switzerland were probably the better side, had the better chances, but it was extremely tight. I think the big thing for England was they showed some really good fighting spirit when they looked like they might be heading out to recover, with Bukayo Saka producing that moment of magic for England. And I think overall the substitutions that England made were probably a bit stronger than the ones that Switzerland did. And, you know, in a game settled by penalties, five nerveless, perfect penalties. And those are the margins. Manuel Akanji, terrific performance. However, he failed from the spot and England are through.
Mark, you're live with us from the streets of Dusseldorf. Talk to us about the atmosphere in the stadium when the winning penalty went in, and I guess subsequently now all around you.
Incredible scenes. I mean, joy for all of the England supporters. Relief as well, I think, because I think they knew that they were in a really tight game against the Swiss side that were well organised, adjusted throughout the 90 minutes and then in extra time as well. Showed real tactical flexibility. They're delirious with joy, but I think they're also aware that they got a bit fortunate. The one thing I would say is that the England fans I've briefly spoken to feel that that was probably their best performance at this UEFA Euro. Although I guess from their point of view anyway, the bar hasn't been set especially high so far. But certainly they feel that this was a move in the right direction, given the change of formation that we saw from Gareth Southgate.
And how much of the story do you think, Mark, centres around Bukayo Saka, not only for his goal, but his nerveless penalty?
Well, I said it in commentary. I mean, you remember, of course, from the last UEFA Euro final, his failure from the penalty spot was the decisive moment that allowed Italy to win the trophy. He's been putting them away for Arsenal pretty regularly, and I'm sure that it would have been going through his mind that he has been here before in an England shirt and it hasn't gone so well. So you have to give him tremendous credit for the way that he stepped up, had the bravery to take the penalty and then also the brilliance to stick it away.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, guys.
Commentator Mark Scott there. Mark mentioned Bukayo Saka's miss in the Euro 2020 final. Saka said post-match, to come back from something like that was really difficult. I used it to make me stronger, and today I took the chance, so I'm happy. Here's what Gareth Southgate had to say about the Arsenal man too.
He's a dream to work with. He's a fabulous boy. Such a good professional. So much fun to be around. Does an amazing job for the team with and without the ball. And tonight, special for him, special for Trent, special for Cole Palmer, Ivan. You know, they've all had to go in there, and you must take it for granted, Jude, but, you know, they're young players in extreme pressure situations. But we felt that with the players we had on the pitch, they were the best to take the penalties.
Gareth Southgate on Bukayo Saka, who wasn't the only penalty hero for England, Chris.
No, again, Jordan Pickford for England. And there was a wonderful picture that did the rounds quite quickly after full-time of his water bottle with every member of the Swiss squad on it, and which way or not that he should dive and whether he should do a fake or what he should do.
Not even maybe he'll do this. It was like, just do dive
that.
Left, dive right.
Manuel
really
Akanji,
clear, wasn't it? Yeah.
Dive left.
Yeah.
He did so, and that was the decisive moment, which then enabled, ultimately, England to win the shootout with their perfect penalties. But interesting. He absolutely stuck to that water bottle. I wonder whether if it happens again, if an opposition member might try and get that water bottle. And
he did make a fuss of going to get it, didn't he, before the first penalty?
Which, yeah, caused a little
bit of
a delay.
He was like, wait, I need to see where he's going to kick it.
Yeah, and you wonder whether that was a bit of kidology. You know, goalkeepers like to do that now, but maybe it was just because of the notes that were printed on that. It does mean that you can't lose them, which is a good thing. But moreover, on penalty shootouts, and maybe Gareth Southgate's legacy, Andy, that, you know, England have only ever won four, and they've now had three with him as a coach. He also won one as a player. But to change that narrative around, I mean, I know they lost the last Euro on penalties, but that is quite considerable, isn't it, given English footballing history?
I think it is, because it becomes a trope that hangs over the players, you know, even if they weren't directly involved in that. And it's interesting because, of course, Southgate is remembered, or was remembered until he was England coach, for his role in the losing penalty shootout in 1996, when he missed,
I think,
of course.
The defining England penalty miss prior to his appointment as manager.
I think so, because until he was manager, that was really the closest England had come to winning a trophy since the World Cup in 1966. Of course, Italia 90 fans might slightly disagree with me, but, you know, that felt like it was England's time in 1996, and they didn't quite get there. So I think maybe when you look at his reign as a whole, you'll probably go back to when Eric Dyer put away the winning penalty against Colombia in the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. That changed a lot. But to build on that and to be able to attack it with such confidence, really, you never felt like any of those England players were going to do anything other than score. Similarly to how France approached the penalty shootout against Portugal last night. And, you know, it's fine for the coach to have a strategy. All he can do is pick the players, and then they have to interpret it. And they have to not just do their best to score, but project confidence while they're doing it. And that can put an enormous amount of pressure on the opposition, I think.
Yeah, top quality kicks from Cole Palmer, Jude Bellingham, Bukayo Saka, Ivan Toney, who doesn't look at the ball, does he?
Ridiculous.
He just stares the goalkeeper down as he kicks it. And the Alexander Arnold winning penalty. Andy, your thoughts on the game itself? Because England came in with this changed formation, three at the back, much discussed. Switzerland were unchanged. You know, Marit Yakin said he didn't want to mess with anything from the Italy win. How did you see the match itself?
I think the shift of shape worked for England, at least initially. I thought they were fairly good first half. Second half was a different story. And I think when we look at the most coherent teams of the tournament up until this point, certainly before this round, I think you would probably say Spain, Austria, Switzerland.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the team with the greatest players in the tournament. Of course, they've got a lot of talent on their books, but, you know, I think France and England have the squads that are the envy of other teams in Europe, and that's fair enough. But the collective of Switzerland has been excellent. They set out their stall in that first game against Hungary and have really just grown from there. But I think, as Mark Scott was saying before, England's ability not to panic after they went a goal down, after conceding a relatively late goal, that was very, very impressive indeed. And really, it was a triumph of nerve above anything else.
Well, let's hear Trent Alexander-Arnold then, who scored the winning penalty. He's described his emotions after stepping up for that final kick.
A lot of practice goes into that moment, the moments that I enjoy. And when the gaffer tells me I'm taking one, there's no, you know, my belly doesn't drop. I enjoy it, I practice it. I knew what spot, I knew I just need to execute it. And when I did that, of course, all five penalties from us were great. Pickers with an amazing save to start the shootout gives you that confidence. But, you know, we practice with these. You see, every game so far has gone to extra time in the quarterfinals. So, you know, the tight margins, you know, the finest of margins today, but we've been able to win.
One of England's subs who proved crucial on the day, Chris.
Yeah, he came on very late, actually. And maybe it was to take the penalty, as you heard there. One of England's heroes. Let's get the thoughts from a disappointed Swiss camp. Now here's their midfielder, Jerdan Shaqiri.
Yeah, I think it was a great game from both sides. I think we went in front and, yeah, what you can see, England, they played differently than the other games, and they were much better in the game. So, yeah, in the end of the day is 1-1, and then you go to the penalties. this is 50-50, and yeah, you must say that England today had the better nerves in the end of the day, and yeah, they won.
Well, he was really unlucky when he hit the frame of the goal direct from a corner.
Nearly won the game. Incredible.
Worth mentioning, they had a number of chances late on in extra time as well, and the Swiss very unlucky not to reach a first ever semi-final in a major tournament. It is England who are there to meet Netherlands in Dortmund on Wednesday, the 10th of July. That's some showdown, right, Andy?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I think when you look at this as being billed as the easier half of the draw, in inverted commas, we've still ended up with a semi-final between two authentic giants of Europe. Two groups of fans who have travelled in big numbers as well in the self-billed capital of German football, as Dortmund calls itself. So
a great venue for this game.
Yeah,
by the way,
it really is. Look, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. Interested to know whether it will be the white wall or the orange wall. We'll have to wait and see. But look, I think it's going to be fantastic. A lot of people have expected more from England so far, but I think they're beginning to grow into this tournament in terms of, as we said, guts. Nerve, which I think is something that Zerdin Shaqiri touched on when we heard from him just a minute ago. And the Netherlands as well, who played very well for all of the Romania game, for some of the game against Turkey, and dug in when they had to. So these are two teams that we know are going to fight really, really hard. It's going to be a compelling spectacle, I think.
Chris, quick one to you on team selection. Does Mark Gay, back from suspension, come back in? Does Wout Vekor start for the Dutch after his brilliant cameo?
Quite possibly the latter. I think the former, Gareth Southgate, who is now a centurion in terms of games as a coach, has always been If someone is in the team, they tend to stay in it, and Mark Gay has played very well this tournament, so I would expect him to come back in. It's interesting that Andy mentioned, and they absolutely are, England and the Netherlands, you know, two great footballing nations, but they've also only ever won one major tournament each. You know, the FIFA World Cup in 1966 for England, the Netherlands at Euro 88. This now becomes a major opportunity to rewrite the record books, rewrite their own legend now in their respective nations, because one is going to be in Berlin in the final.
Still to come, we'll look ahead to the other semi-final. It is Spain versus France.
Few major competitions do more than the Euros to ensure their benefits last far beyond the final tournament. Since 2004, our hat-trick programme has been distributing two-thirds of every Euro's net revenue across Europe's 55 football associations to fund development projects. These benefits touch every level of the football pyramid. In communities, it pays for mini-pitches, grassroots club development, football in schools and disability football projects. At the top, hat-trick has helped associations build more than 60 stadiums and training centres. Euro 2024 will build on more than 800 projects already delivered over 20 years of hat-trick. Over the next 4 years, 935 million euros of the tournament's revenue will help leave a lasting legacy across the continent.
So the first semi-final takes place in Munich on Tuesday.
Neat touch from Rodri. Ruiz to play it through. Morata's on his way. It's Alvaro Morata. It's 1-0 Spain. The skipper pierces through and La Roja's smile is broad.
Nico Williams is onto this, and Georgia could be in trouble. Nico Williams to send Spain through! An emphatic finish from Nico Williams to surely finish off Georgia.
Dani Olmo.
Mikel Moreno!
In the 120th minute, Mikel Moreno!
it's the man in the mask for France, 1-0. Kylian Mbappe scores at the European Championship for the first time in his career.
Colomani, it's in! France have the lead with 5 minutes left to play. Randall Colomani's hit.
Teo Hernandez to take France into the semi-final of Euro 2024. France have done it.
Yeah, finished second in their group, Les Bleus, before the wins over Belgium and then Portugal. Spain, meanwhile, they really impressed, didn't they, in that extremely difficult group with Italy as well. Won it and have 5 wins from 5. I think they have surprised people, Chris, though, Spain.
Yeah, we've been talking to them a lot on the Euro show. I think this is a game that was almost the pre-tournament favourites for many, France.
Yeah.
Against the current tournament favourites.
Maybe,
in Spain,
yeah.
Who
yeah.
have, we always knew, had fantastic players, but I don't think they were necessarily in the majority of people's top bracket of who might win it. But now it comes down to the semi-final. Munich is going to be a fantastic venue for this game as well.
Let's get the latest from the Spain camp with our reporter, Graham Hunter. Graham, good evening.
Hello, welcome to the country which has brought this Euro alight.
And it's been a good one too. And Graham, look, we have to stop by giving you immense credit for looking into your crystal ball and saying that Spain would beat Germany in extra time because of the subs. I mean, my word, that came up.
Well, you're only redressing the balance because although it was my strong perception and I really believed that there was something to it, I put it to Danny Carvajal. He went, no, I disagree. There's absolutely no gap in level between the two sides. So by the end, when there was a really strong argument from all the starting footballers, particularly, for example, Rodri said, the guys who came on, now I think it was 6 lads, is that right? The 6 who came on all came on with the right attitude, dribbled past Germans, played with intelligence, added greatly to the performance. And while Olmo and Marino combined, as in 2 subs, to win it, the general attitude was something that I was trying to get to when we last chatted, which is it genuinely feels this is a 26-man performance. There's only one footballer, I think, who hasn't been on the pitch competitively yet, which is the third-choice goalkeeper, Ramiro. Other than that, everybody has acted as if they could win it, acted every day as if it's vital, how they train, what their attitude is, how they talk to us, how they express the character of the squad. And I genuinely think in a pretty titanic match, I think we saw that above and beyond the Olmo cross for the Mikel Merino goal.
And Graham, you already talked to us about the incredible story about Marino and his father, both celebrating goals in Stuttgart, 33 years apart. But what about that other sub? What about Dani Olmo? Now, of course, losing Pedri is a huge blow, and we'll talk about in a little minute about the availability for Spain that De La Fuente has going into that semi-final later in the week. But Olmo provides something a little different to Pedri. Obviously, a huge blow to lose him early in the game. But Olmo provides that extra goal threat. He's quite different to what we traditionally expect of a Spanish midfielder from their golden era, isn't he?
No, I'll back you up completely, Andy. And I think the first thing, I suppose one of our duties is supposed to be that we open the box up and show a little bit what the workings are to the listeners, to the podcast. And one of the things that maybe they won't know, because many of those who listen will have seen him in the Bundesliga, might have seen him playing for Zagreb in Croatia, is that this coach really, really likes him. There are a couple of talisman players for De La Fuente above and beyond, you know, the players who are obviously vital. And Lamine is one because De La Fuente immediately gave him his debut and said, yeah, you're ready. Fabian Ruiz is another. He's an absolute touchstone talisman footballer for this coach, but so is Olmo. It's partly based on the relationship they built when the under-21s for Spain won the title against Germany, if I remember correctly. It was Fabian Ruiz had an impact in that under-21 final. But Olmo was named man of the match. And therefore, during the 2 friendlies, which was against Andorra and Northern Ireland prior to this tournament, there was this sense in the media about, well, we're waiting to see, is Olmo ready? When will he be fit? When will he be sharp? And while Olmo only came on for Pedri yesterday, there had been pretty gigantic speculation right across all forms of the Spanish football media, electronic and printed, that Olmo would start in Pedri's position. Now, it didn't happen. But what I would say to answer your point is that Olmo is more direct. He runs at players. He's physically different from Pedri. The footballing styles are different. But when he came on, just to hand it back to you, Andy, is that he was ready. And I go back to an interview I did with him at the beginning of the tournament. I said, will you be ready? How are you coping with being on the bench? And he said, I will be ready. I knew that because I missed a few games towards the end of the season, this might happen. I'm 100% now, and I will be ready. And as you both pointed out there, he was.
Graham, it's clearly been a squad effort from Spain, but to what extent are they hurt by the three absentees now in Carvajal, Lenormand and Pedri?
Robin Lenormand, I think he's deeply underrated. Dani Carvajal is not underrated. People understand that only he and Paco Gento have started six winning Champions League finals. But then Pedri. Pedri's a gem. Pedri's a diamond. He changes how Spain play completely. And there was room in a Spain side for Olmo to start, say, at false nine, which has been talked about a lot, and where he played during parts of yesterday's game, yeah, with Pedri in the midfield. So big losses, no question. Spain will play differently and maybe are slightly more vulnerable because of their absences.
So, Graham, you knocked it out of the park with your prediction game last time. What about this time against the French?
I'm not going to betray what I wrote for our website at the beginning, which is Spain to win the tournament. But I'm going to have to justify that because, although I'm not sure how many people you've spoken to about France's performances, and they have looked a little bit jaded and a little bit tired, but they regularly in recent tournaments have still been able to get over the hurdle and get to a final. So I look upon, particularly with Carvajal missing, I look upon Barcola and Dembele, not just Mbappe, as having fearsome counter-attacking pace, and therefore I'm nervous. I think Spain's momentum, mentality and resources, even without the three we've talked about, are sufficient that I think they will win. I believe that Williams and Lamine Yamal will come back to being the key again. Look at how early Lamine was taken off by Luis de la Fuente, which looked like a gamble, but it looks like a good one now because freshness is guaranteed. So I'm going to say to you that I think this time Spain win within 90 minutes. And I'm going to say to you that I think Spain win by two clear goals.
You heard it here first. Graham, thank you for coming on.
Pleasure.
Our reporter Graham Hunter in with the Spain team. Let's hear from one of their players now, the hero from their quarterfinal, Mikel Moreno.
I think the important thing is the mentality. We are so close of achieving something important that we only have to do what we do always, to be professional, rest, sleep, eat good, and with the motivations that we have in our mind to win this thing, I think it would be easy to be 100% ready for the next match, for sure.
And Chris, it gives us a meeting of arguably the two most successful European countries of the past three decades.
Yeah, not just in this competition, but in the FIFA World Cup as well. I mean, the stats are quite scary, to be honest. Since France won the World Cup in 1998, they've, including that, had four finals there, of course, in Euro. They won it in 2000. They were runners-up in 2016. And then Spain, I mean, that incredible period when they won this great competition twice and won three in a row because they lifted the World Cup as well in 2010. I mean, it is arguably the two dominant forces, I guess, of recent times, Andy. And they met in a pretty big Euro final as well back in the 80s. I mean, it's going to be a fabulous occasion. And this is what happened when they met at the Parc des Princes all those years ago.
And Bellon is onside. And France could end really with a flourish now. Bruno Bellon, 2-0. It's their championship. Hidalgo has finished at the top.
Talking about the coach, Michel Hidalgo there, who led France to glory. And that was a major victory because they then didn't win anything between 84 and 98. Andy.
Yeah, and the first major title that France's national team won. So Hidalgo is a huge part of their history as a coach. So we tend to think of 1998 as France establishing themselves as a superpower. And you're right, Chris, with everything it's led to, that's correct. But this was, I guess, Michel Platini's tournament, 1984. And Spain couldn't stop him, the same as Portugal couldn't stop him in the semi or anyone else before that. And that really changed France's self-image. But since 1998, it's been an absolutely glorious run, really, from France, with a few little blips along the way. But, you know, they come into tournament after tournament after tournament as favourite. Spain, of course, have been chasing for the last decade after that glorious period, because, as you say, such an incredible period, an unprecedented period of winning those three successive major trophies. And after 2012, when I think really they gave the consummate performance in a UEFA Euro final in Kiev in 2012 against Italy, beating them 4-0 in the final, I can't think of a more definitive final performance in a World Cup or a Euro than that. And it's really hard to hit that standard again. You know, exceptional coach, exceptional generation of players. And, you know, to try and get anywhere near that, it's impossible. You've got to try, but it's impossible.
How do you see the game going? Because if you look on paper, the amount of attacking talent, which is going to be on display, from Spain's two wingers to Mbappe and Griezmann, you might think it's going to be really open. Do you think it will be like that? Or do you think the pressure of a semi-final, the size of the prize for the winners might come into play too?
Yeah, I think it might. I don't think it's unfair to say that it could. And of course, France are cautious at the best of times. Now, what they realise, though, is that they're going to have to put the ball in the back of the net. Ousmane Dembélé, after being awarded the man of the match yesterday, he said that, didn't he? He said that we've just got to be a bit more clinical in front of goal. They have created a lot of good chances in this tournament, France, without being able to take them. But what I thought was really interesting in that quarterfinal against Portugal, the fact that Didier Deschamps bit the bullet. He took off Griezmann. He took off Mbappe. And Dembélé, Barcola, they were able to come up with the goods. And I think it's given him a lot to think about. So whereas Spain will have to make changes, as Graham was saying, because of suspensions and injuries, I think France might make changes because, you know, no one is guaranteed a place. Now, I genuinely think that's the case with France.
Well, let's get more of a view from the French camp now and speak to our reporter, Alex Clemenson. Alex, thanks for joining us from Paderborn.
No, thank you very much for having me.
So what, 24 hours on from France's nerve-wracking win, how are they feeling? How is the French nation feeling after that still?
I think there's a little bit of relief. I think, obviously, the stability that they've got defensively, I think that's something that's so reassuring for them. I think there's obviously concerns about their attacking fluidity, the fact that they still haven't scored from open play. But when you've got Mike Maignan and you've got the defence that they've got, I mean that gives you reassurance, that gives you sort of confidence in getting results.
You spoke to Didier Deschamps last night, Alex. What did he have to say after the win over Portugal?
I think, I think there was a little bit of relief. I think there's an admittance in the camp that they can't carry on this way. Obviously, I think they know their issues that are involved in front of goal. I think that's obviously something they've tried to address that they haven't really found the remedy for yet, but that's obviously something that's got to be a theme through training the next couple of days. But I think he said it himself. Obviously, a great defense is incredibly important throughout a tournament, but it's not something that wins you games. It's something that prevents you losing. But obviously, I think the focus will turn to their attacking form, how they find a way to sort of score from open play. That's obviously something that it's incredibly problematic at this time. But I'm sure that's something they'll be looking to address in the coming days.
And what is the view of Spain? I imagine there is great respect given how they have played at Euro 2024 so far.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for the neutrals, they've obviously been the best team so far. I think obviously Rodri's pulling the strings from the base of their midfield. That's obviously something that's got to be incredibly important to focus on. How do they combat that problem? How do they combat the wingers that have been so dangerous, so fluid looking? Obviously, I think it's been a major theme throughout the whole tournament for France. They look incredibly strong defensively. William Saliba has been imperious. as does Maignan. But yeah, obviously, yeah, Spain are looking good, but I think France have the confidence. Obviously, their recent record in previous tournaments, going on to win 2018 World Cup, obviously going so far in the 2022 World Cup, obviously not conceding from open play themselves. I think they'll take a lot of heart from that. But yeah, Spain pose a different test to what they've come up against so far. So it'd be an intriguing encounter, but I'm sure they've got full confidence in their abilities to go all the way and put their place in the final in Berlin.
And we've seen tweaks to that 11 in midfield and attack. And Adrian Rabiot returns from suspension. What do you think he's going to do?
Yeah, obviously Rabiot returns, but I'm not sure whether that's set in stone that he comes straight back into the starting 11 on Tuesday. Obviously, Eduardo Camavinga was one of their star performers, actually, on Friday night. I think he added industry, he added energy. He obviously had that great chance relatively late on to actually open the scoring. So that could be something that Deschamps will have to look at. Does he tweak it yet again? I mean, he's changed his midfield system pretty much every game so far. Where does Antoine Griezmann fit in? What do they do with Kylian Mbappe? I mean, there's so many questions, but when you've got a squad full of the talent that France have, I mean, it's not necessarily a problem. So it's one of those headaches that are great to have as a manager. So it would be intriguing to see how Deschamps sets his side up on Tuesday.
And Alex, we just heard from Graham Hunter, who predicted Spain to win by two clear goals. So it's your turn now. What's going to happen?
Obviously you did. To be honest, they have looked incredible so far. Every time you speak to anybody that's watched the tournament, has had the chance to actually watch many of the games, Spain have been miles beyond the best team to watch as a neutral. I'm confident France will secure the victory no matter which way. I don't know whether it will be going to extra time, going to penalties. I think at some point, obviously, we know that there's so many levels that this France side has to reach. And I'm fully confident. I've said it every time before every game that they play. I think they've got the tools at their disposal to win games at a canter. I'm not sure that'll be the case, but I definitely think they'll get the win.
Tuesday, 9th of July. Let's find out, Alex, if you or if Graham is correct. Thank you very much for coming on.
No, thank you very much for having me again.
Our France reporter, Alex Clementson there. So it's Les Bleus against Spain. That is the first last four tie. A reminder that today England and the Netherlands set up the second semi-final of UEFA Euro 2024.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. We're getting some reaction. Let's hear from the player of the match and a goal scorer as well, Stefan de Vrij.
Yeah, it was really a battle today. The Turkish team, they have a big heart, a lot of quality, and sometimes we suffered them a little bit. But I think in the end, we did well and we deserve the win tonight.
Well, we're getting some more reaction as well from the Dutch camp now. Here's Nathan Ake looking ahead to that last four tie with England.
Yeah, it will be good to see them. Obviously, they have a great team. Yeah, they had a difficult match today, but also them, they can see the mentality to go through again. It will be a good match, difficult. We know the quality they have. Yeah, as you said, I know them very well. So, yeah, we're going to give everything to go through.
We'll play club teammates like Carl Walker, Phil Foden, John Stones, Van Dijk against Alexander-Arnold. There's going to be loads of interesting head-to-heads going into that semi-final. Andy Brassel, it's been great to have you back on the show. So you're back on Wednesday after the second semi-final.
Yes.
So let's hold you to account. Self-proclaimed European football expert, of course. who's going to be in the final, do you think?
France and England.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I think, you know, you can, they're going to be two very tight semi-finals. They're fascinating for all the reasons you've underlined. I think there's a big performance to come from France in this tournament.
Come on,
still.
Chris.
So France
what do you think, actually, Chris?
No, I was just, if we're sitting here on Wednesday and it is Spain against the Netherlands, we can introduce Andy Brassel very nicely there. Andy, top stop as ever. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can listen to us every match night, moments after the final game, on the Euro 2024 app and at Euro2024.com around 11 PM CEST or later, given we are now at the semi-final stage. It could be extra time. It could be penalties. The show also available as the official podcast. Please subscribe using your favourite podcast provider.
Yeah, the semi-final lineup is complete. Spain, France on Tuesday in Munich. And Dortmund's the setting for the Netherlands
against England. My thanks to Chris and Andy, and thank you for listening. Reminder, we'll be back on Tuesday as well to react to the first finalist being confirmed. We hope you can join us.
Thank you for listening to the official Euro 2024 podcast, an IMG production for UEFA.